Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a former employee adds to his list of accusations that Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden had created a negative working environment, that even as the sheriff makes a strange speech to recruits. $700,000, that's what the city of Charlotte will pay to settle a suit brought by the family of a mentally challenged man who was shot by CMPD in 2017. CMS begins phase two of its comprehensive review of student assignment. They're examining demographics and school capacity with an eye toward wrapping it up by March. And despite Charlotte FC's playoff hopes ending last weekend in Orlando, they still get some good news this week. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE Senior Editor for News and Features, Lisa Wharf. Nick Oxner is WBTV's Chief Investigative Reporter. Hunter Sines returns. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. We put them in separate rooms. And Eric Spanberg is Managing Editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. Don't all speak at once now. All right, thank you. Over the last week or so, reports of racism, mismanagement, and bullying have been swirling around Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden. His second-in-command, Kevin Canty, resigned earlier this month after only 8 months on the job. And on his way out, he sent a blistering letter making those accusations. And here's what he told WFAE's Steve Harrison.
I heard him make racist comments. He would refer to black employees as being on a plantation and having a plantation mentality. And that was usually reserved for black people who dared push back or have a different opinion or who presented evidence that contradicted certain themes that he was trying to get across.
It should be noted that both former Deputy Chief Canty and Sheriff McFadden are black. Is this the first time that we've heard accusations like these levied against the sheriff? Anybody?
No, this is not the first time.
I think this is the most public and credible. Yeah. And Mike, I think what's more important to note here is Canty didn't just make these allegations, which he first said to my colleague Naomi Coles last week, the day after he resigned, but he also provided Naomi, and has since been public, a recording of the sheriff, which hopefully we get to, of the sheriff making some of these comments.
Lisa, do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I was going to say, no, this is not the first time. Yes, very specific this time, but you've had employees throughout the last couple of years coming forward, including the man who was in charge of the jail a couple of years, spoke with us at WFAE, that blamed the problems at the jail, with his mismanagement.
Eric.
And you also had the Fraternal Order of Police, I think it was in 2021, with a letter that condemned his behavior. So there is a history here.
Well, and also, Canty, it should be pointed out, the guy who's leveling these accusations is a 32-year veteran of law enforcement with more than 25 years with the State Bureau of Investigation. He says he voted for McFadden twice and, quote, as a black law enforcement officer, was proud and happy when he became the first black sheriff of his home county. But he adds that he was shocked at what he described as the abusive, insulting, condescending language used in talking to his command staff at Canty's first meeting back in February. He says those meetings constituted public floggings of other officers, other members of the sheriff's department on the front lines. Also come forward. Nick.
Well, just yesterday, Naomi talked to another senior executive who was fired by McFadden on Wednesday for what she alleges an act of retaliation, who again said on camera to Naomi, everything Kevin Canty said is true and accurate. And again, we should highlight, you know, on this language, Canty didn't just make these allegations. He provided a recording. That recording has now led to an apology from Sheriff McFadden for the language he used.
Which, in fact,
these are not one-offs.
Which, in fact, we will get to in a second. Eric, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was about to mention the apology, but we'll wait until you play it. So
Canty characterized McFadden's comments to and about his staff as racist.
And I told him that I thought that race was in play and that I didn't think that the majority of the employees who were black would allow him or would have allowed him to treat them the way that he does if he had been a white sheriff, that they would have gone to the media a long time ago or would have filed grievances. And I also told him that I didn't think that he would treat the majority of these black employees the way that he does if they were white.
And Canty also alleges that the sheriff has, quote, no leadership ability, no knowledge of basic concepts of managing a process. There have been 18 deaths at the detention center during McFadden's six-year term, more than previous sheriffs in a similar time frame. But it is also true that McFadden has spoken about his changing the culture of the sheriff's office for the better and making the jail more humane. He calls the inmates their residents. Can both of these things be true?
There's nothing humane about people dying in your jail. And if you look at the lawsuits that have been filed against the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office, and you look at the things, I hate to keep talking about Naomi's work, but it's been so good and revelatory here. You know, she obtained video that shows a corrections officer at the jail, at the Mecklenburg County Jail, not properly doing checks on a mentally ill inmate who later died by suicide at the jail. And we have the court record showing, for instance, that staff member was directed to lie under oath. These are all things I can say unequivocally because we have it on court record. Lie under oath. When you look at the spike in death at the jail, no, you can call them residents, but if you're not keeping them alive, that's not humane.
Yeah, there have been a lot or there have been several lawsuits coming out in the last couple of years. And you see things like, you know, one case there was an overdose and it took a nurse from the document saying it was over an hour to treat. And, you know, this was 3 years ago, but you had, you know, the state coming in and saying, you know, there's an imminent threat of danger because of short staffing in this facility.
Hunter, then Eric.
Yeah, I was just going to note, I mean, besides the tragic deaths that have happened there, technically under his watch at the jail, you also have other problems like the gun permit process and lawsuits stemming from that. You talk about a derailed and very slow process that people have sued over. I think that speaks to probably what Mr. Canty is getting at. Another example of it, you have the negative inspections by the state on the jail. You have the closure of Jail North, which was our only local juvenile jail. And so now juvenile suspects are now being driven 3 hours away from their family, which we know is crucial to their rehabilitation. So I think there is a plethora of examples scrutinizing the processes that are put in place under his leadership.
Eric?
I think, you know, when you take what was just mentioned by Nick, Lisa, and Hunter about some of the things that have gone on, and then you pair it with Kevin Canty is someone who's been in law enforcement for over 30 years, spent 25 years with the State Bureau of Investigation, and according to the interviews he's given to multiple media outlets, he was, in essence, polishing his resignation letter for months on end because he saw these problems and was cataloging the leadership deficits, deficiencies that he was seeing. So these are some pretty serious charges.
So Sheriff McFadden made a speech at a deputy graduation ceremony last week, which has been characterized by some as strange, where he spoke about watching the stars in officers' eyes go out. I wonder why that would be. And although he hasn't directly addressed these accusations, he alluded to them during that speech as the elephant in the room.
The elephant wears green. That's my color. That's the uniform I have. My character and my integrity are being criticized. But let me assure you this, and you can ask anybody. If you believe I'm racist, you need to talk to me. If you believe I'm racist, you need to talk to the kids who come and see me. If you believe that I'm racist, talk to the people who know me.
And he also explained what these new deputies could expect from him.
Is he yelling and screaming and talking? Yes. Is he pushing us? Yes. Will he push us? Yes. Will he ask you a question? Yes. Will it be direct? Yes. Will you look for a direct answer? Yes. Are you racist? Absolutely not. How can I be for something that I live with and I breathe it every day? I wouldn't want this on anybody.
He referred to him at some point in that speech, he referred to himself as a sacrificial lamb. It became somewhat religious for a moment, but someone who is doing what he needs to do. So could these accusations be people who just don't like his style? Does it necessarily mean that he's doing a bad job?
Well, you've seen this. I mean, you've seen these accusations for a few years now, you know. And in the beginning, McFadden would explain them by saying, this is the old guard that is in here and doesn't like me and causing problems. But now you see this, you know, in this recent spate, you know, people who are definitely the new guard in here.
Yeah.
And you also look at some of the shuffling he announced yesterday in departments, that it looks like he terminated two heads of departments recently.
WSOC TV spoke with Aileen Maddox, who was the sheriff's office chaplain for 13 years. She now lives in Ohio, but she told the station that she too saw similar negative behavior exhibited by McFadden.
I saw several majors and I know chiefs who left because of his lack of understanding of what it means to be the sheriff of Mecklenburg County.
Again, she was at the department for 13 years. She quit in February, and I think that's just as Deputy Chief Canty was coming on board. She told Channel 9 that once McFadden arrived as sheriff, her stress level was so high that she was afraid of having a heart attack. And it's taken her months, she says, of getting assistance from a counselor to, quote, get past the anger. But she also says that she had never witnessed McFadden using racial slurs. Why is she just coming forward now, Hunter? She spoke to Channel 9, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's taken the time needed, as she had mentioned, in getting counseling. I think she even spoke, I believe she told Jonathan, with either attorneys, making sure that she was safe to come out and speak. I think Canty coming forward first probably helped her. And there's that first one. Now I feel like I can be empathized with by somebody else. But I think what she has told Jonathan and has said really speaks volumes. I mean, when you think of 13 years there, she has seen a lot of leadership at that jail. She talked about how she thought it was going to be a breath of fresh air when McFadden came there, and then she was waiting for that good change, and she says it never really happened. This is also a woman who, she may not have seen things directly herself, but she is the chaplain who speaks with numerous people on different levels there. That is her job, technically, of course, with inmates as well. So she has heard from a lot of the rank and file there, and what they have heard, including what we heard Canty say regarding people saying that they are, quote, feel like they are working on a plantation. We have heard that time and time again. She heard that time and time again from people who worked there, who came to her.
And he has said that some of the black officers act as though they're working on a plantation. So it all kind of comes together. For people who don't remember, Gary McFadden was a member of CMPD and also had a television show. I think it was a syndicated television show. So perhaps, I won't say it. When we come back, I want to talk more about this letter, or this video rather, that WBTV obtained. And then we'll hear McFadden's apology that he issued yesterday, kind of an apology that he issued yesterday. We'll talk about that and more. There's a little dust-up going on at CMPD as well. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We are with Lisa Wharf, senior editor for news and features at WFAE News, Hunter Sines, reporter for WSOC-TV, Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Yesterday, in a pre-recorded video, Sheriff McFadden issued an apology for the racially charged language that he used in a recording that WBTV reported on earlier. Somehow you obtained a copy of these recordings. What did he say in those recordings?
Well, let's be clear. We got a copy of this recording from Kevin Canty when he sat down with Naomi Coles after resigning. So there's no mystery to that, and we've been transparent about where the recording came from. And even before yesterday's apology, the sheriff never denied the existence of the recording or having said those words. But that being said, I think this apology from the sheriff is notable, one, for its timing. It comes the same day that the Sheriff's Association's executive committee, the North Carolina Sheriff's Association, met with him after having first kind of admonished him or issued a public statement denouncing him for the use of this language. And so he issued this apology, saying that he has to be better than this and hold himself to a higher standard.
I was going to go into that right now. In that apology, he recognized that as sheriff, he should be held and is held to a higher standard.
But you must understand that I'm human and I'm not perfect and I will make mistakes. The interviews will come because they have the luxury to talk openly and freely. But by law, I am not, because I'm bound by law and I can't speak openly and freely. But I'm still committed to this community. I'm still committed to the residents in the Mecklenburg County Detention Center, and I'm still committed to my staff.
So the interviews that he's referring to are the ones that former employees are giving to the media as they come forward after former Deputy Sheriff Canty came forward. Is he legally bound not to say anything?
No, there's no law saying the sheriff can't talk. Broadly. And so this is one of those things where public officials who want to avoid things just say, well, I'm legally prevented from talking. I mean, we got one email from a spokesman for him yesterday that just said, quote, per the law, but didn't cite a specific statute. Probably what he's talking about is the personnel laws that do objectively prevent people from talking about specific personnel situations. However, there are two caveats to that. One, you could get the employee's permission to talk about it, and there are these people making these accusations. Two, as we saw the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board do several years ago when they fired Ernest Winston, you can actually put a memo in an employee's file that justifies the need to talk about them in their employment file to maintain public confidence in your office. And you can do that and then publicly air their personnel file without any legal recourse. So he could talk about this if he wants to, but also he could give an interview about why he used the phrase, quote, white cracker captain, and why he referred to a former chief deputy by the N-word. He could talk about that. There's no law preventing him from talking about that, just so we're clear.
Eric first, then Hunter. Eric?
Well, picking up on Nick's point, yeah, I mean, there is the limited scope of personnel matters, but as Nick just said, he could address most of these things are not about specific personnel. They're about his behavior with the broader employees. He can certainly talk about how he manages, why he does what he does as a manager. The other thing I was going to mention, we didn't hear it in that clip, but in the apology video, he also pointedly said that he runs the largest detention center in North Carolina, which sounded perhaps like a response to some of the issues that Lisa and Nick were bringing up earlier.
Okay. Hunter?
I was just going to note, I think one of the most frustrating things that probably a lot of people have on this whole issue is some people may forget that he's an elected official, so technically a politician in all of this. So when he's asked these questions, he treats it as such. Case in point, right after that Sheriff's Association meeting, my colleague Glenn Counts was there and kind of chased him out of that meeting and asked him point blank, was it you on these recordings? And before he put out his apology, where he inadvertently, I guess, admits without admitting full-fledged, he said, what does the community think? And Glenn said, no, but what do you think? I'm asking you. And he said, what does the community think? And I think it's very telling when you have a leader who still isn't saying yes or no, it was me. If you were the leader, take it. If it was you, admit it, apologize, move on. You know, and we see these politicians speak of that and call other politicians out to do that, but they won't do it themselves.
So as you have all mentioned in the course of this conversation, we've been hearing this in drips and drabs over the years, and now we have a rather damning set of accusations coming from this letter that was written by his ex-second-in-command. Will these accusations be investigated? When and by whom?
I'm not sure that there will be an investigation because I'm not sure that there's anything criminal about anything that's been levied. It's also important to remember that the sheriff is a man who works for himself and reports to the voters every 4 years. He's not up for election for another 2 years. And so, you know, while the county commissioners ostensibly have some power of the purse because they fund his agency, that's a nominal oversight role. The sheriff, by the North Carolina Constitution, is a constitutionally elected officer, can do what he wants. There's a quote from a sheriff in Bladen County years ago. It's in my book if you want to read it. But he says, the only two people who can remove me from office is God or a Superior Court judge. And that's accurate. That's what it takes to remove a sheriff.
What's the name of that book again?
It's called The Vote Collectors, Mike. Thank you for asking. Okay. Still available.
You're welcome.
Now on paper.
All right. Moving on, because that's not the only law enforcement issue we have to deal with this morning. WFAE Steve Harrison also broke a story late yesterday that Charlotte City Council member Tariq Bakari told Police Chief Johnny Jennings this past summer that he would put maximum pressure on the city manager to fire the police chief, and went on to say that he would work to, quote, cripple the chief's legacy. Lisa, why?
This was all over outer vests for officers. Apparently, Bakari was saying that he had been wanting the chief to allow officers, all officers, to wear these. And then it really heated up after the shooting in April of the 8 law enforcement officers that went to serve a warrant in East Charlotte. Now, 4 of those officers were killed. Mm-hmm. And Jennings had said, look, you know, 3 out of 4 of those officers were wearing those vests, and I don't believe they offer extra protection. And so at that point, there was WFAE Steve Harrison did a public records request and found that, you know, there were these emails back and forth saying from Bokari, hey, you know, those, you know, if you don't allow these, I'm going to exert that maximum pressure to fire.
Steve reports that as these text messages flew back and forth, the two men knew that there was going to be a rift between them. And in one, Bakari texted Jennings that he, quote, had made a terrible error in judgment and that he, Bakari, hated what would come next, but continued, quote, as your friend, I want you to know what happens next. I'll be demanding your resignation starting Monday. I'll be hammering you from the press, the private sector, the foundations, the General Assembly, Congress, and several high-profile national organizations. And he gave the chief 36 hours to compromise on his decision. Was that compromise reached?
Well, not initially. So a few weeks later, though, CMPD said officers could apply to wear those vests without a medical waiver. So it did happen.
So what has Chief Jennings said about this, if anything?
I don't think he said much.
Meanwhile, a city manager, Marcus Jones, praised Chief Jennings and his 30 years of service, saying he has, quote, demonstrated time and again his strong leadership, adding, I have supported him and will continue to support him. I did speak with Mr. Bakari and told him that I did not support his demands of the chief or his approach. So, does that conclude this matter?
Well, we'll see. I mean, what's interesting in this case is right, the, you know, city council getting involved in these small decisions, right? They're used for the bigger policy decisions. And so, you know, this is a curious incident where that's happened.
So sticking with CMPD for a moment, the city of Charlotte settled a lawsuit this week just before the case was to go to trial. The suit was filed by the family of a man who was shot and killed by police officers in 2017. Remind us of Ruben Galindo Chavez's story. I think, Hunter, I think you have this one.
Yeah, so in 2017, he called 911 and they were able to get him a language interpreter. He was Spanish speaking and told them that he had a gun that was unloaded and basically needed help. When officers arrived, they see him there with said gun. They tell him multiple times to drop the gun. He doesn't. The officer sees that as a threat, shoots him twice, kills him. There were no charges by the DA's office at that time against the officer, but the family filed a lawsuit against CMPD and the officers that we now know was settled, as you mentioned, for $700,000. In that lawsuit, they said that he suffered from mental health challenges. And also, because of that language barrier, he didn't really understand what the officer's commands were.
Well, you pointed out that
they needed to be better trained.
You pointed out that when he called 911, they had to get it. You pointed out when they called 911, they had to get a translator on the phone to let them know what was going on. But there was nobody who really spoke Spanish when they arrived on the scene. And it came at a time, in fact, the chief at the time, Kerr Putney, blamed the death on that communication barrier. And at the time, I think the number of officers who spoke Spanish was very low in comparison to the Hispanic population in Charlotte. So they've agreed to pay $700,000 to this family. Has the number of police officers speaking Spanish increased over the years? Has there been a policy change that might send a translator out with officers? Has any policy changed? And will it change going forward given the $700,000 we just had to pay out?
I don't know on the specific policy of any policy changes that have been implemented to send a Spanish-speaking officer, per se, to a call that one is needed. I know multiple officers who are bilingual just out on the job working through my experience being out there. I don't know if the numbers have technically grown. I know that there are many officers who do speak Spanish, so I would assume so. But I will say there has been implemented change when it comes to crisis intervention team, when it comes to mental health providers being sent to some of these, many of these mental health calls, the training that CMPD officers, some of them go under in order to respond better to a mental health crisis versus no training at all. So there has been some new policies and trainings implemented since this happened.
Believe it or not, we're going to switch from police work to a completely different subject because also, believe it or not, election voting is still going, or election counting is still going. Vote counting is still going on. On Monday, the State Board of Elections said that more than 15,000 mail ballots have yet to be counted. And that could make the race for one of the seven seats on the North Carolina State Supreme Court even closer. How close is that race between Democrat incumbent Allison Riggs and her Republican challenger Jefferson Griffin? Eric?
I'm going to let Nick take this because he was speaking on it much more knowledgeably than me.
Okay, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, the race is roughly, I'm going to use round numbers because I'm a reporter and don't do math, roughly 5,000 votes, just maybe a little more than 5,000 votes currently. That's going into today when the county boards of elections across the state will meet and finalize the vote tallies. And so after that, if the margin is 10,000 or less, then we're likely headed to a recount.
This is a critical race, particularly for Democrats, because Republicans hold the majority of seats on the Supreme Court. I think there are only two Democrats on the Supreme Court. This would take it down to one if Jefferson Griffin were to win this seat. And she has never been elected. She was appointed first to the Court of Appeals by Governor Cooper, and then she was appointed to the Supreme Court to fill a seat by Governor Cooper. Is that partly why perhaps it's so close, or is it simply that we have shifted clearly from this last election to the GOP?
But look, the Republicans have, made gains on the North Carolina State Supreme Court for years. It's been part of an effort by Republicans to win the court. And now the Democrats are mounting their own counteroffensive to try to take the court back. Of course, these are partisan, even though the law is not partisan. The General Assembly about 10 years ago made the court partisan and then started seeing gains as a result of it. But Allison Riggs herself has said that she has to win this election, and in part of her campaign, she had to win this election in order for the Democrats to be able to have a shot at retaking the court. And that's what they see as being at stake here. Arguably, she was appointed to both of her seats because she is a political person. She was a civil rights and election law lawyer representing Democrats and liberal causes, liberal leaning causes. And so, you know, a lot of jurists tend to not want to get into politics, but she's comfortable doing that. And so she may argue that it is so close because of her political background, and that's what got her competitive.
Griffin is ahead in this race at the moment. Riggs won nearly 64% of the mail ballots counted so far, and county election boards have to also review 60,000 provisional ballots by the end of today. Mecklenburg County Elections Director Michael Dickerson says that in a typical election, about 40% of the provisional ballots end up counting and are often a 50-50 split between Democrats and Republicans. Is there likely to be a recount on this race?
If it's less, if it's within that margin, it should be about 10,000 votes or so. Yes, I think there will be. I think the Democrats view this as a pivotal must-win thing, and so they will do everything to ensure that all the votes are counted and to be doubly sure, you know, that the vote count is whatever it is. And I think likewise, the Republicans would do the same if Griffin ends up coming out behind Riggs after the provisional votes are cast. But, you know, let's not forget that Chief Justice Paul Newby, when he won his election to Chief Justice over then incumbent Chief Justice Sherrod Beasley, was, you know, a microscopic margin as well. So this is just the latest in a string of razor thin, super tight elections for the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Well, this election was almost 2 weeks ago. Now, it'll be 2 weeks next Tuesday that we all voted at the polls and that polls closed. How many other races are still being decided or are still undecided? Let's say that.
Well, I mean, we have a couple of close ones in Mecklenburg County, you know, but the Southern Senate seat, South Charlotte, Woodson-Bradley has about 200 votes over Stacey McGuinn at this point. And the Cotham race was pretty close, too, with her ahead, of course.
So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about voter turnout in Mecklenburg County, which was low again. Also, the city council, most of the city council heading off to Munich last weekend when the Panthers were playing the Giants there. And a little bit about transparency, Nick's favorite topic, because of the decision by council to end the employment of the city attorney and then not telling us why. That and more. So don't go away. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Nick Ochsner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV, and Lisa Worf is senior editor for News and Features from WFAE News. A publication called The Assembly ran the headline this week: "The state's Democrats ask, what the meck?" Mecklenburg County has the most registered Democrats in the state, and again, Mecklenburg County voter turnout was low. We were near the bottom with 69% voter turnout as compared to 73% for the state. Both seem low to me in a national election, but that's what it was. But that's not necessarily the only reason the Assembly was asking that question. They were asking because the vote for Harris in Mecklenburg County was 6,000 votes below what it was for Biden in 2020. That was as of last Wednesday. It could have changed, but it mirrors a national trend. So, Eric, what does this mean for Democrats here going forward, or what does it say about how they conducted their pre-election exercises?
I think, similar to what's going on all over the country, there is a blame game going on. There's a lot of questioning going on. But as you said to start, Mike, there is a history in Mecklenburg County of low turnout. For example, Wake had 76%, Durham 72%, Guilford 73%. You can go around the state, and they're all higher. And the gentleman who wrote the article you referenced for the Assembly was on with WFAE this week and was saying that there are all kinds of factors, even though the Democratic Party finally put a little more money and had a little bit more of an effort in Mecklenburg County. They didn't yield any better results. And, you know, they're asking questions. And at the same time, we have a lot of turmoil within the local Democratic Party. Had the executive director step down. I believe
alleging racism, by the way.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. Alleging racism, and then Arthur Griffin, that Steve Harrison had reported, asking for or saying that the chair of the Democratic Party, the local Democratic Party, should step down. So you have the historical legacy, you have the additional investment not paying off, at least initially, and then you have the internal turmoil. So there's a lot to sort out for Democrats here in Mecklenburg County.
I mean, and that was a big boost in the investment this year. So. Yeah. You know, that's intriguing.
I suppose that because we are so blue, that people, maybe Democrats, feel they don't have to vote because we have an entire, almost an entirely Democratic city council and an entirely Democratic county commission. Maybe they don't have to vote, but we seem to eschew democracy in Mecklenburg County, if a mark of democracy is your privilege to vote. And so I asked Mayor Lyles, when she was on this program on Wednesday, what her theory of the case was.
I can't address how people make their final decisions on choosing to be part of the process or not. I do think that sometimes Charlotte is a little bit different. So we actually talk about Charlotte being different than Greensboro and from Raleigh. If I lived in Raleigh and every day I was walking by the state capitol, maybe I'm more, really conscious that I have the opportunity to do these things. I don't know the answer to that, Mike. I'm not so sure that there is an answer.
There's probably an answer. We just probably will never figure it out. Eric?
You know, I just listening to the mayor and then just the general tenor of this conversation, look, everybody knows, or almost everybody knows, that Mecklenburg is the largest area for Democrats. We know that the presidential election in North Carolina has been close, the past 20 years, give or take. And we know that making up that deficit is in part reliant on Mecklenburg County. And oh, by the way, Vice President Harris and Tim Walz, her running mate, were here about every other day. So it's just baffling how that message didn't resonate, or people simply just turned it off and said, I'm not interested.
I know Lisa wants to get in on this, but I think it's also interesting that there were higher voting totals for Democrats in certain precincts than in others, but one of the lower precincts was Precinct 41, which is in the city's Crescent, the lower income communities of color, and they delivered fewer votes for Harris as compared to Biden in 2020. Lisa?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's one, the lower turnout, but also WFAE Steve Harrison had done an analysis, and when you look across the county, there was a slight shift toward Trump, and you saw that, you know, in Mint Hill, a district like that. You saw that in wealthier parts of Charlotte, and you saw that in neighborhoods that had, a lot of Black residents, too. So that was also another part playing in this whole dynamic.
Well, moving on to the city council going to Munich. The majority of council, in fact, along with six staff members, 14 in all, went to Munich, Germany last weekend. Just coincidentally, the Panthers were there to play the Giants, where they won. But also, they were there to cultivate stronger business ties, we are told. Eric, people might be surprised at the number of German companies and enterprises that have a significant presence in Charlotte. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, the German ties, of course, we have to start with Queen Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, all that stuff. So there's your history lesson. But yeah, 200 German companies that are in and around Charlotte, accounting for 20,000 jobs. That's roughly a quarter of the foreign investment related jobs in the area. So there is a strong link. And at the same time, I think where you're headed with this is, people are going to ask and deservedly so, why are so many people going? What is the mission, and is the mission accomplished? We don't have a lot of those answers yet, other than we know who went, we know what they did, we know it cost about $6,000 to $8,000 a person to go, yep. But as for the results, we don't have those yet.
Well, members of council and staff stayed in 4- and 5-star hotels at an average cost of $825 a night, although the final tally on that's not yet in. The cost just for rooms and air travel was estimated by, I think, WCNC-TV to be about $80,000, and I spoke with the mayor this week about that.
I can't validate the $80,000, and I do know that we will have a report, as you said, after everybody turns in their, you know, it's just, government sometimes is just like a business. You know, you go on a trip, you have to put down all your receipts, you have to submit them to the finance department, and then they have to give you a reimbursement. So we'll know more as soon as that process is done.
But we live in a Zoom world in which meetings like this are done virtually. So I pressed her on why this was billed as such an important economic development opportunity, one that would elevate, to use their words, the Charlotte brand.
It's important to know that it's not just the City of Charlotte trip. It was the Alliance and the North Carolina Economic Development Commission. They're helping us to recruit and encourage people to come here from Germany and be a part of our community.
So we won't know what this is going to do in the future for Charlotte, but in the past, Eric, because this is not the first time this kind of a trip has been taken, in the past, have they borne fruit?
They used the example of there was a company that came here as a result of, I think it was the Paris NBA game with the Hornets a few years ago, and there was a delegation that went over. Mike, I think that people kind of have their feelings baked in on economic development and spending money because it's such an inexact science. It's like talking about advertising or something, you know? It's like something could happen, a friend of a friend, 3 years later. It's very murky, and I'm not trying to absolve anyone or take sides. I'm just saying it's really hard to get your hands around what exactly the benefit, the tangible result of trips like this are. And so one of the things I'm interested in is the report that's coming from the city, I guess, within the next couple of weeks, I'm told, by the economic development director, outlining what they think they accomplished and what's still to come.
Nick?
I'm going to say something shocking and say I don't really see a problem with city officials going to Germany and spending taxpayer dollars. It seems reasonable. However, if you want to get public buy-in, you have to know how much you're spending. So the mayor, $80,000, I don't know, maybe. The public starts to lose the trust that their tax dollars are being wisely spent when you can't give them details on the front end of how much it actually costs or specifically what you're doing. And so once again, we have a public agency in Greater Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, who's not sticking the landing on providing public transparency and details. And that's why the public doesn't trust them to spend tax dollars wisely, even on a thing that arguably they should be doing and going to a place where we have a lot of business and drumming up more. Those are good things. The lack of transparency.
Speaking of trust and transparency, we also spoke to the mayor this week, Nick, about something near and dear to your heart, transparency, and that was in the light of the city's recent decision to end the employment of city attorney Patrick Baker. Lisa, the majority of council and the mayor made this decision several weeks ago, and it appeared to involve WFAE. How so?
Well, it involved WFAE because WFAE had filed a public records request, basically, and that the city, it took a while for them to drag out as far as their transportation plan. But then Patrick Baker said, yeah, here it is. And by law, he has to. So that came up apparently in the backroom discussions, as Steve Harrison has reported, as one of the contributing factors in this whole process, the termination process.
Yeah, the council released a memo regarding their decision to end Patrick Baker's employment, but they did not disclose the reason for it. So I asked the mayor.
I can't comment on that because of state law. There's a general statute in our state that's statewide that protects confidentiality of state employee personnel records, which includes the people that work for our government. And so we have acts that say that this is confidential, and until that confidentiality, we're not going to abuse it.
So, Nick, this may not have any connection to Mr. Baker's decision to release the public record at the request of WFAE in order to comply with state law, but then again, it may be connected. During this closed-door meeting that they had, we are told that Mayor Pro Tem Dante Anderson told Baker that he had leaked that document, but it is a public record, so leaking it is not necessarily accurate. Will we ever know what the reason for this decision is?
Probably not. Now, I am going to do a second crazy thing. I'm going to give the mayor props for her detailed explanation when compared to what we heard earlier in the show from Gary McFadden on why she can't talk about a personnel issue. And you heard her very explicitly cite that statute, not just the law says. She's generally right. She could, again, they could do what the CMS did with Ernest Winston a couple years ago, and they could get around that and explain. It's not super surprising. Patrick Baker's kind of not been a favorite at the government center for several years. He's kind of been under scrutiny by the, you know, and a lot of people don't like their lawyers. I say as a guy who relies on lawyers to keep himself out of trouble frequently in my reporting. A lot of people don't like their lawyers. You know, and I'm sure he gave them tough legal advice over the years. And so, unfortunately, she's right. The law says, unless they do a very specific thing that is hardly done, they can't talk about this. And we could argue maybe shouldn't under the law, which is unfortunate when you have a high-profile decision like this.
So we have talked with you and other reporters on this program over the years about transparency and their frustration with getting access to public records. Even city council has expressed frustration over their getting access to public records. And so I asked the mayor about this in general, and she says sometimes the requests are just too complex to be fulfilled quickly.
But I do believe, and that some of this discussion will help us look at it differently. And I believe council will have some ideas around how do we do this, because you know, sometimes they're acknowledged, sometimes you get them within 24 hours, but sometimes you don't get them for a long, long time because of the complexity of the way that you address it. And it's really hard to say to someone, here, take this back and rewrite it so that we can get it faster to you. It's not happening.
So does that ring true? Lisa and Nick,
what fantasy land is she living in?
I guess it doesn't ring true.
What fantasy land is she living in where the city's producing records within 24 hours? I mean, it's just disingenuous. And requesters, as someone who requests a lot of records, if you came back and or picked up the phone and called me and said, what are you actually looking for? Could we narrow this down a little bit? Which she said couldn't do, which happens all the time. It is just disingenuous. Absolutely. This is the kind of thing from public officials that really makes me angry. And if the mayor were really committed to it, they would actually sit down and talk to the people asking me for these records. I mean, the city had a backlog years old of producing records. And that's not because someone asked for two documents or something that's hard to search for. That's because the city is fundamentally not committed to transparency. It's inexcusable.
And this has gone on for years. Gone on for years. This is not new. We've been through multiple attorneys, administrations,
clerks,
city
councils,
managers,
mayors.
It is a constant.
Are we an outlier, or is this something that goes on throughout the state in various municipalities or at the state level or in other states?
I would say I actually get a faster and more complete response from Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, who I've sued multiple times for violating the Public Records Act, than I do from the city of Charlotte. That being said, I recently heard from the clerk's office that they are switching to a new software that they hope will allow them to be more responsive faster. So while I still think the mayor's comments are not grounded in reality, I do recognize some efforts by the city and the clerk's office to staff up within the last year or so and try to be better.
I have about a minute left. We must not leave the air without talking about the second most important story of the week, and that is the Tika K deer problem and the solution they have found. Lisa, this is not good for the deer.
I was hoping the story would be that. Yes. Yeah, so so they tried Tika K. They have over 1,000 deer wandering around, and they recently had a sharpshooter come out, only was able to take 36 of them down, and so they decided they were going to go the sterilization method. So they ended up tranquilizing about 200 deer with darts and removing their ovaries or tying their tubes. And so we'll see how that works.
Much to the deer lobby's chagrin. Very quickly, Eric, I know you're the expert on all things Charlotte FC. They lost their playoff hopes, but the team got good news this week. One of their goalkeeper was the goalkeeper of the year. Quickly, fill us in.
Yes, first time we've had an end-of-season honor for Charlotte FC, and they took Orlando to the brink. So overall, good season.
Christian Colina was that player, by the way. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV, and Lisa Wharf from WFAE. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.